Thank you for joining us for Digital Book Report 2015 with June Parsons. Thank you, June.
Hello, welcome. I hope you all had a wonderful lunch today. Last year at the conference, we looked at Michael Porter's Five Forces model and how that was affecting the publishing industry, in particular the textbook publishing industry. And we looked at five factors, including the ones that are outlined in blue, industry rivalries. We looked at the threat of substitute products or services. We looked at bargaining power of buyers, and we looked at the threat of new entrants. What we really didn't look at was the bargaining power of suppliers, and that's what we're going to look at today. Now, just to kind of recap, though, a little bit, because I did promise some overall information about the industry and to do a little bit of an update. So in 2015, when we look at industry rivalries, meaning this is what happens between the competitors, the publishers that are in this textbook publishing space, okay? So the textbook industry, as we all know, is still dominated by a few really big established players. In the college market, it's the big four, Cengage, McGraw-Hill, Pearson, and Wiley. And in the K through 12 market, it's McGraw-Hill, Pearson, Houghton Mifflin, and Macmillan. Another factor that Michael Porter talks about is the threat of new entrants into a business. So here we have this big publishing industry, right? We've got the big four and the big three. Now, are they afraid of new entrants? What are the pressures that they have of people with people coming in? And I talked last year about some of the possibilities of new entrants, like OpenStax, which is a free textbook publisher funded by Bill and Melinda Gates. And, of course, we all know about Chegg, which specializes in rentals, Flat World Learning. There's the Open Textbook Library, sponsored by the University of Minnesota. Again, freebies, okay? So we have this free model. We have the kind of rental model. And all these things are entering into this market, causing disruption. There's more disruption this year than there was last year because there are more of these companies coming into the space. Then we have bargaining power of buyers, buyers being students and instructors who adopt the textbooks. There are alternatives that the buyers you are looking at, renting books instead of buying them, used books instead of new books, pirating our digital books. It looks like the bargaining power of buyers is starting to take effect. There's been a lot of publicity about the cost of textbooks that students are paying, and so there's been a lot of pushback on that pricing. The publishers are not exactly listening. The price of print textbooks has remained about the same in the past year. The publishers have another scheme up their minds, which they're trying to push. And I apologize for those of you who are sitting in the back. I took some time before lunch. I enlarged all the fonts on my slides, but this one was a can slide. It comes from the McGraw-Hill Global Educational Holdings Investor Update for this year. Okay, yeah. And so what does this thing tell us? This will take a while to look at. Laura talked about too much information on a slide. This one's got a lot of information. Okay, so we've got the dotted line over here, and the dotted line is cumulative digital solution sales. So that's sales of digital books. All right, and the solid line over there is the sale of print books. Now, what they did was this is a study for a single course, and we're thinking of 100 students in the course. Okay, so what happens? So we start at semester one. Okay, this in and of itself is heartrending. Okay, so semester one, what happens is 9 students buy the digital book and 12 students buy the print book. This is out of 100 students in a class. Okay? So then what happens, 18 students buy the digital book and 20 students buy the print book. See, I'm over here. Okay. Cumulative, yeah, 18 have bought it, right. 26, 27, okay, so it accumulates over here until we get to 12th semester. This book is, you know, like older than the hills, but students are still buying it. Now, down at the bottom, though, see, here's the accounting part of this thing. So what happens is that the print version, this is their capture rate, and the print version, the book price for the print is $130. The book price for the digital is $98. So the textbook publishers say, hey, students, we've got a deal for you. It's only $98 for the digital book. Wahoo. Okay. What they don't tell the students, but what the students know anyways, is that they can't resell that digital book. Okay. So they're out there $90 or $98 that they spend for the book. Whereas with the print book, you know what happens. The second semester, there are all these used books out there, and the publisher gets nothing, basically, for those used books. So their capture rate goes way down. So what they've said is, okay, we start out with a 90% capture rate on print. It goes down to 65%, and then 55%, and then 45%, and then 30%, and my God, we're not making any money at all. But with the digital, we make 90%. We get a 90% capture rate every semester because the students have to buy the digital book. They don't have a used book that they can buy. They can't rent it from Chegg. They're going to have to get it from us. That's what they're getting back. That's the rate of return on the sale. Okay, so that's the model that the publishers are looking at. Digital is their big hope because there are no used digital books. All right, threat of substitute products and services. From last year, there are still several platforms that are competing with the publishers. And there's an interesting thing that's going on. There's kind of this merging seems to be taking place between the learning management systems like Blackboard and Desire to Learn and publishing platforms that have content. MindTap, Cengage's digital brand, Pearson's Learning Studio, for example, McGraw-Hill's LearnSmart, those are the publishers' platforms that contain the publishers' content. And these publishers, it's a proprietary platform. So if you're going with Cengage Books, you're going to use MindTap. If you're going with Pearson Books, you're going to use the Pearson Learning Studio or one of their other alternative digital platforms. In other words, if you're a student and in some of your courses you're using Cengage Books and in some of your courses you're using Pearson Books, you're going to be using two platforms. But some of these Blackboard and Desire to Learn, they're thinking, oh, what about one platform, our platform? And so they're trying to make deals with the publishers to pull in the content to those alternative platforms. So that's a to be decided we'll see what happens in the next couple of years. We'll see if that works out. Now, what I really didn't talk about last year was bargaining power of suppliers. We know that the publishing industry has suppliers. They include paper merchants, commercial printing companies for print books, and we have cloud service providers for digital platforms. And then there are authors. And in fact, we as authors are suppliers to publishers. And it's interesting for us to take a look at that. How are we suppliers, and how does that fit into Michael Porter's Five Forces model? A few years ago, in 2012, Dan and I went to a Tools of Change conference in New York, and Margaret Atwood made a presentation at that conference. And this is the slide that she put up. It says, when a moose dies, it feeds over 36 other species. It is a primary source. And then she put up this slide. You see, this guy is the author. And the author has a book. The author is the primary source. And who feeds off the author? The booksellers, the agents, the reviewers, the printers, the publishers, the editors, and the librarians. And there are more with digital platforms because they're all the platform providers. Okay? So the author sustains many life forms. We as suppliers sustain many life forms. But the publishers don't get this. No, they don't get this. So, this past year, I conducted a survey of authors. I was just curious, you know, where are we at here in this profession? And with the help of the TAA and with many of you who I think probably answered the survey, yes, okay, we had 92 participants in this survey. We sent out about 450 emails to ask people to participate. So our N is 92 participants. And we got some very fascinating results. So the first graph that I have up here is the year your first textbook was published. And of the respondents, the first textbook was published in 1965. And if you look at the graph, and for the people who are in the back of the room, this peak in the graph here is between 1981 and 1989. So what does that tell you about us? Well, most of us have been doing this for a long time. Okay, for subject areas, we have a lot of people who are writing in the social sciences and the natural sciences and mathematics and computer science. We also have a fairly big contingent in business. And authors are fairly experienced in the subject matter that they teach. We had two people who claim, they must be 150 years old, to to have taught for over 45 years in the field that they're authoring in. Mm. And actually, I checked out one of them. I kind of could make some guesses about that person. And yeah, actually, that is probably the case. Okay. And newcomers to the field, you know, when we look at the under 20-year group of instructor teachers, you know, there are still, most people have quite a bit of experience in their field. So publishers, at least for this group of authors that we surveyed, publishers seem to regard experience as a plus. Now, whether that is the case moving forward, we don't know. And I'll talk about that a little more later. Okay, companies that are your primary publishers, as expected, we have a lot of Pearson, Cengage, and McGraw-Hill authors. All right, what you've all been waiting for. What's the highest royalty rate you've negotiated for a print book you've authored? Uh-huh. So those publishers who tell you that they never pay more than 8%, you can now tell them what they can do. Because they are lying to you. All right. And interesting, I broke this down a little bit for you. Okay. So when we look at the between 15 and 20%, you can see, okay, a lot of 15%ers and a few 12%ers and a few 18%ers over here. We'll let that sink in for a moment. All right. Okay. And then what's the lowest royalty rate you negotiated for a print book you've authored? So some people believe the 8%. But a lot of people haven't. And this also, to keep the survey short, I didn't go into a lot of detail, but I think there were some people who were a bit confused. It just wasn't clear. So if you were the co-author of a book and you got 4% and your co-author got 4%, perhaps they answered the 4% as their lowest royalty rate, whereas that book really had an 8% author royalty rate, okay? And then I just broke down one of the brackets, the 8 to 14%, and you can see that even though with that lowest royalty rate, like between 10 and 11% is the lowest royalty rate that people are negotiating. Okay, and on to some digital stuff. So a lot of people have digital editions of their textbooks. And most of them are sold in the publisher's proprietary format. That's that second bar, over 50%. So Cengage, you're going on MindTap or CourseMate, Pearson Learnings. PDF files are the second most prevalent format for digital editions. And you can see that apps, like Android apps and iOS apps, are not particularly prevalent. Perhaps I think the publishers have, one, they want people to be in their own platform, and two, on these other platforms, especially the iOS apps and iBooks, Apple is taking a big share, 30% of the profits, and so the publishers, that doesn't work with the publisher's model. Have you viewed your digital book? This is an interesting question because I would think that if you have a digital version of your book, you want to take a look at it. But about almost 30% of the respondents in the survey had never actually taken a look at their digital book. And for those who had input into creating their digital books, most of them had input in the pedagogy. A lot of them had input into the media and video that went in the book. Fewer authors had any input on the layout, and quite a few of them had input on interactive quizzing. R- royalty rates for digital. Okay. It looks like the trend is to have the royalty rates the same for digital and print. I was surprised that a few people do have a higher royalty rate for the digital version. I'd like to explore that a little bit more. Pirated copies of your textbooks, you know, they reduce the sales and the royalties. Digital versions tend to be more vulnerable to piracy and unauthorized sharing. So as we move to digital, it really is important for authors to keep their eyes open for pirated versions. Also, make sure that if you see those, you report them to your publisher. And for those of you who are working on new contracts, you may want to consider putting wording in the contract that compels your publisher to do something, and maybe not just something, but something specific when you report to them that there are pirated copies of your work out there. So some of you weren't quite sure about what happened in terms of royalty rates when your books are sold outside of North America, but it's very important that you keep a look at that in your contract, and there are several reasons why. One is because usually royalty rates are lower for books sold outside North America than they are in the U.S. Now, with digital books that are coming from a digital platform somewhere out in the cloud, there really is no reason to reduce the royalty rates for books that are sold to people who are outside of the U.S. So make sure in your contracts that if you have some kind of clause about the royalty rates for print books being a reduced royalty rate, that that is not the case with your digital books. What about bulk and wholesale sales? Okay, be especially vigilant about what your contract says about both the print and the digital sales through Amazon and similar channels. Your publisher may consider these channels to be wholesalers, and your royalty rates will be reduced accordingly. Okay, what about non-compete clauses? Most of you have a non-compete clause in your contract, which prevents you from creating a similar work for a different publisher or publishing a similar work yourself. Are these things good? Probably not. But they're very hard to avoid. One respondent to the survey said something very interesting. This person said that his or her contract specified that the non-compete was only valid as long as the publisher did not publish a work that competed with the author's work. I don't know how that person negotiated that, but fair is fair. You know, that sounds fair to me. Okay, does your contract give you the right of first refusal for revisions of new editions? 43% have yes. 14% said no, and 34% are not sure. For those of you who are not sure, find out. It looks like there is a trend with publishers to eliminate the kind of author royalty relationship that we have with the publishers. What publishers would like, many of them, what they would like to do is they would like to hire people to create work for hire content. People who they can pay once, and then the publisher will own the content. they do not have to ask you if you want to revise the work. It's no longer your work. It's the publisher's work, and they'll do whatever they want with it. That's a very, very disturbing trend for us. So check your contracts. If you're negotiating new contracts, think carefully. What happens when the publisher no longer wants to publish your textbook? J.K. Rowling kept the copyright to all her work. Maybe enough said right there. But make sure that you work with a knowledgeable lawyer or agent to protect your copyright. Publishers are going to try to weasel out of this clause because they don't want you taking the copyright, taking your book to another publisher, or publishing it yourself. Why? Bad for them. And be careful with the wording on this, because publishers, as I said, they're going to try to weasel out of this, and one way they do that is by keeping your book in print, even though it's not selling very well. Yeah? Okay, so, yeah, warning on that. All right, do you have a sunset clause in your contract? What's a sunset clause? Sunset clause is when you no longer participate in a revision, do you get some royalties for the intellectual property that you've put into the first few editions? So 51% of you of the authors surveyed had some sort of sunset clause in their contract. And what do those sunset clauses look like? Okay. So nobody was able to negotiate getting half of their royalty rate for all subsequent editions. But, and I thought this was quite interesting, there were a couple of respondents who were able to get half of their previous royalties for the first edition that they did not participate in, 25%, and then for all subsequent editions, a 2% royalty. But think about that, because when you write a book, you create that book, you create the idea, you create the pedagogy, you have invested your intellectual property in that book, and despite the fact that other people may revise it or change it, that initial intellectual property was yours. Okay, a very common and the most common sunset clause was that the author got half for the first edition, then 25%, and then nothing.
Fight to get your sunset spread over maybe four editions than the evergreen, not just two, but.
Good point. And you can use that as a bargaining chip, too. The more that you want, the less, you know, they may then compromise at a place that's a little more reasonable. Yes.
The other thing here is to get something in perpetuity. To get a certain percentage rate in perpetuity.
Yes, that would be like this 2% for all subsequent editions, or the evergreen, I love that term, evergreen. Okay, one person was able to get 10% of the previous royalty rate for all subsequent editions. Hooey, that's great. And then some people get no, one person had no royalties for editions that they don't participate in. Now the next slide was a shock to me, all right? So the next question I asked was, in 2014, approximately how much did you receive in royalties for your textbook? What's the dollar amount? Ta-da! Look at that. what shocked me. I was very surprised. I mean, this is, you know, this is lucrative. This is a lucrative business that we are in or were in. And you can see that the publishers are saying, we're paying these people this much money when our bottom line is not looking so good. And so they're trying to find any way they can to reduce people's royalties and hold them to their contracts, or to get rid of them altogether and bring in contract workers, work for hires. So you've all taken your photos of this one? Okay. All right. Okay, so back to this five forces model. I mean, we've looked a little bit about what's going on with us as suppliers to the publishers. Okay. What is our bargaining power? Do we have bargaining power? Is it increasing? Is it decreasing? Well, our contracts obviously are the major source of our bargaining power. Data, like the data we collected on this survey, I think helps us bargain more effectively. Before I did this survey, I had no idea, really, what kind of royalty rates had been offered to authors. What can you do? You believe what the publishers tell you, 8% is standard. Then you find out it's not, okay? Let's get the microphone over here.
Just for perspective, I'm totally ineligible. What is typical royalty rate in the fiction market or non-textbook nonfiction?
Somebody else may be able to answer this better than I, although my understanding is that it is in that market about 8 to 9% if you are going through a major publisher. Self-published trade book authors tend to get more in the 30 to 40%. They do not have the services of marketing and sales forces behind them. So they're doing their own marketing, which means they're not selling as much unless they're one of the breakout digital authors.
And the dollar amount of royalties that you showed, do you have any data of those authors that are part-time versus those that are full-time?
No, I do not. And that's a very interesting question. I really want to do a follow-up survey because now that I have this basic sort of baseline data, I've seen some places where I really want to delve in and get some more information. And I also haven't really had a chance to do correlations. For example, you know, like if you're writing in the business area, are authors making a lot more royalties than people who are writing in the social sciences? So, you know, there's a lot more to be discovered here, I think. All right. So we can bargain royalty rates for our print books, for our digital books. We can look at our offshore royalty rates. We can check to make sure that we're not being beaten on the head when our publishers are selling through Amazon and other online sources. Many publishers are just, they hold the line at royalty rates and they won't change them. If you have a contract and you're renewing a contract, your old royalty rate is what you're going to get. There's no way that they're going to change that. And if that seems to be the case, then you can go for what I call the perks, okay? You can try to change the sunset clause. You can try to reword the non-compete clause. So there are things that you can negotiate. There are things that you can bargain about with your publishers. But we are bucking some very strong forces, which really reduce our ability to bargain. One of the things that reduces that ability is this trend to work for hire. Okay, a word on the street is that one of the major educational publishers is trying to eliminate all of its author royalty contracts and to move to work for hire contracts. Another thing that we're fighting is that the publishers like to keep authors in the dark. They don't like to tell you. They don't like to have a strategic plan about, okay, when are we going to bring out your next edition? What's that going to look like? What are the royalties going to be? They don't even like to tell you sometimes how the sales are going. You don't know until you get the royalty report, right? Yeah. They like to keep you in the dark about what other authors are doing and what they are doing with the other authors, what royalty rates they're offering. There are a few contracts out there that prohibit authors from revealing their royalty rates and the terms of their contracts. And, of course, we are all fighting this disruption that goes on in the publishing industry. Publishers are in disarray. There are too many factors beating on their heads for them to be able to deal with. Let's face it, some of the recent bankruptcies, the Cengage bankruptcy that happened last year, I think illustrates the point. Publishers are having a difficult time responding to A, the digital world, and B, to the disruptors, the alternatives, the free books that are on the market. So we as authors, I think, are in a diminished and a diminishing position to bargain with the publishers. That's unfortunate. That's kind of depressing. Now, that being said, there are some things that we can do. I've mentioned some of the things that we can do contract-wise. Perhaps you have some questions at this point or some comments that you would like to make.
Again, I'm totally unknowledgeable, so I was wondering, it just came to mind, is does anybody negotiate for just a flat dollar amount per book sold rather than a percent? I will get $6 for this book per book sold, no matter whether it's digital format, North America, or print, et cetera.
One problem with that is each of the publishers, the net price creeps. So in some of them, it's a six-month increment, maybe a one-year increment over a three-year edition, and that net price creeps up. Now, we've been fighting to get their net price to go down so that they're competitive with used books. But if you had a flat amount, you would not be able to take advantage of that increasing net cash price that they creep up during the life of your editions.
Let's just ask anybody in the audience, do any of you have a contract that gives you a flat rate for a book? I don't think a publisher would do that, and another reason is that they like to make deals. You know, they like to make a deal with the school. You buy this book this semester and for 1,000 students, and we're going to give you a really good price at your bookstore so that you can pass that price on if you want to your students. Or they're going to bundle something with the book, some ancillary materials. Okay, so I don't think that happens. Actually, I tried to do something. This was many years ago when we first came out with a CD that went with our book. And I didn't want them to do a lot of bundling or end up giving the CD away, and so I said, how about this? You just pay me a dollar for every CD that you sell. I don't care how much you sell for, but just pay me a dollar. They wouldn't do it. Okay, other questions, comments?
About the work-for-hire trend, my thought is why there might be an increasing push for that is that as publishers move to digital versions and they want to do a fairly large investment in that content if they're putting it in MindTap or the Pearson system, and then they're going to want to maintain that afterwards, they're not really going to want the author involved in that because their revisions are going to be very difficult. So the work-for-hire, I think the move to the digital platforms is going to make them want more work-for-hire. They pay once and they're done. And that may add to that pressure.
I agree with that. Many people have the idea that digital is very easy to change. Oh, it's digital. You know, we'll just go in there and make this change on page 5. There was a typo there. We'll just fix it. No problem. Well, it turns out, no, it's not easy at all. The investment that these companies are making in creating digital books is quite high. And they're usually farming those things out to India, and so they write the spec, and the people in India do it, and they provide the final book. But to send that book, to send a page of that book back to India and get that changed is not an easy task. And so I think that the trend is for publishers to want to have their digital editions last as long as possible. Also, for those of us who are in the computer technology industry, we have an additional problem if books are tied to software, the technology that comes out, because those things change very, very quickly, and the publishers are not, they're getting less and less fast on their feet, which is very contrary to what we think should be happening. Shouldn't the publishers be using all of the digital tools at their disposal to get editions out faster or more quickly? But no, that does not seem to be happening. They seem to be getting bogged down into this morass of one edition, and okay, maybe we'll make a little appendix for this book for the next edition. So this is a very difficult trend, I think, in the market.
When you were speaking about piracy, are there specific places to look for if your textbook is being pirated?
Well, you can look on some of the file sharing sites. But, I mean, the first thing to do is to just type the title of the book and your name into Google and see where it takes you, okay? And you may be surprised.
So I was just thinking about the whole royalties versus work-for-hire situation, and it seems like there's actually two aspects of that, because on one hand, there's the whole question of, you know, if you're not being paid royalties, then you're not a partner with the publishing company, and you're not necessarily invested in, you know, making everything 110% amazing, because you're getting a flat fee. But the other thing is that the flat fee is negotiable, and it could end up being a good deal. But it's a question of where they're going with that negotiation. Now, I assume they're going to say, okay, here's the total royalties we paid for the last edition. Let's offer them 80% of that or something like that. I don't know, but I'm guessing that they're going to use this as another way to try and push their costs down. But I guess I just want to unbind those and say it's not necessarily a bad thing if you could negotiate, you know, a flat fee that is commensurate with what the book has sold in the past.
You know, I think that may work for some things, but, you know, those people who are earning $500,000 a year are never going to be able to write enough work for hires. So work for hire is a great way for people to get in. But this is sort of like what goes on in corporations when you kick out the experienced high earners and you hire young, inexperienced people, and you hope that the quality of your business is going to remain the same for a cheaper price. And that's what the publishers, I think that's their strategy. Yeah.
So I work for a publisher, and just wanted to make a quick comment that I think the word trend is pretty strong, and I think there are some publishers that aren't necessarily adopting that strategy. And I would say with friends that I have in this room that are authors, there's a direct correlation between that $500,000 level or $1 million, whatever that is, and the quality of the content. And the work-for-hire contracts that I've worked with, they don't necessarily deliver that high quality of content that you see adopters appreciate. So I think in some cases, work-for-hire makes sense, but at least in the business that I'm in, it doesn't make sense.
So I think that you
in some disciplines, it's I think it's different. I think it's discipline. It depends on what area you're publishing in, maybe.
Well, I think you brought up the whole issue of quality. And when we start to inject that into the conversation, we can have a long conversation about that and look at the quality of textbooks and the potential for a sharp decline in quality with perhaps nobody caring about it. And in a sense, that discussion is very difficult to talk about in open forums because you're always you're going to step on somebody's toes when you start talking about that, right? So I understand your point, and I think to say it's a trend is not going to happen next year, and it's probably not going to happen in 5 years. But let's put it this way: there's an idea in publishers' minds that this is one way to solve a lot of their problems. And I think there'll be some experimenting with that, and it may turn out, as you say, that what happens is that the quality is not good, especially in some areas, and they need to back away from that. And that would be good for authors, that would be, I think. And it would be good for the publishers, too. If it's not going to work, they need to admit it early.
I did an example of a work for hire that made sense, which is unusual, but my department was celebrating their 100th anniversary, and they asked me to write the 100th anniversary book, which I did, but it was a work for hire. They basically paid me my salary to do that. Well, there was no market for that book other than giving it away, so.
Yes, and the second edition, which would be the 200.
Hey, June, I don't know if you have the stomach for one more work for hire comment, but one of the things that really started pushing publishers down this road is a little bit like what Dan was saying, but I just want to amplify that. It's not as much of the cost. I'm not saying that in some cases that's not the case, but it's that the content is ending up in all sorts of different recombinations, particularly as you move into a digital environment, and they're looking down the road to say, how are our royalty systems going to track that? And they're having real problems considering that because the royalty systems are essentially based on print. And to get them up to speed to deal with a lot of these different ways of distributing content is difficult. So my experience has been that the prime motivator has been initially, we don't know how we're going to pay for this stuff. We don't know how we're going to do the value allocations. And I think that it's also kind of nice sometimes when you, as a publisher, can say, okay, well, I can probably do this product cheaper too. And, you know, the other thing is that a lot of authors don't get to renew their contracts because they're stuck with the contract that they signed. Yeah. So it does become a different kind of interaction with your publisher to try to improve your situation. Because there isn't always this kind of once every year, once every 2 years, we're going to renegotiate our contract. And it becomes a different kind of conversation, and it's a relationship-based conversation in that situation.
Yeah. So there are content management systems, right, that should be able to track and manage where content is used and how people can be reimbursed for the use of that content. And to be frank, okay, most publishers are very naive about technology. They think that they have some potential solutions, and they all want to do it in-house. They all want to do their own stuff, right? They want to have their own platforms. but they don't know what they're doing. And they don't want anybody to give them feedback. How many of you have been asked, okay, we're all pretty experts in pedagogy, and many of us are pretty good at digital stuff, especially some of us who write in the STEM areas. Okay, and has a publisher ever asked you, well, how should I do this technology on our digital platform? Anybody ever been asked that question? Any focus groups for authors that the publishers are holding? No. No. And have they actually had any focus groups with you to say, this is what we're doing with your textbooks? Come, we're going to show you what the pedagogy is. This is our great digital platform. We're going to do this. Has any publisher ever done that? Yours has? Okay, one. Wow.
I get in there and ask them. I insist on being part of that conversation. So I wonder how widespread that is at my publisher. Elsevier?
Yeah. Although a group of us asked a publisher to do just that, show us the digital platform, give us a little seminar. There were a number of us who asked that. And they said, oh, yeah, of course, we'll do that. And followed up a couple times, and nothing. So they didn't want to. They don't want to sometimes show you the stuff because they know it is really not very good.
Any other questions?
Are publishers responding at all to the prospect of authors self-publishing and having more and more opportunities to do that with greater advances in technology that's happening year by year? Are they feeling the pressure of that? Do they understand that?
I may not be the right person to address this. My feeling about it, okay? My feeling is that this is a case of head in the sand, and that basically the publishers think that it will go away, or they hope that it will go away. But that being said, how have any of you, that's a good question for the next survey. I'm going to try to find out how many authors have tried to do their own marketing, try to do a book on their own. I think that could be interesting. Yeah. You want to make a comment about that?
Mm-hmm. Doing books on your own is tough. But it's also profitable if you have the right marketing set up. And that's the key. With print on demand, we can all do it, right? We can upload to Amazon. We can upload to Lightning Source. We can get distribution through Barnes & Noble and Amazon. That's the easy part. The hard part is marketing. So if you can market it and keep everything for yourselves, good for you. That's what Mark and I have done. And so it's a trade-off. You have to decide what's more important.